I'm Jonathan Seckle. I'm a simple clinical endocrinologist from Edinburgh, although I also have a role in leading science there. And my interests are in the hormones of stress, glucocorticoid hormones, and what they do to us from the beginnings of life before we're born right up until old age. And that's what I'll be talking about today. So first of all, thank you for inviting me to Glasgow. It's no great distance for me to come through on the train from where I hail from, which is sunny Edinburgh. This is a classical picture of Edinburgh. You've all seen Edinburgh many times, of course. It's always sunny, at least in this picture. I've shown it, and for those of you who are scientifically trained, I've now shown this slide exactly 100 times, and on each occasion, the sky's been blue. So it is statistically significantly sunny in Edinburgh. All right. What I'm going to try to talk to you about today is about the hormones I work on, because I'm a simple hormone doctor. The hormones I work on, which are the hormones of stress, and how exposure to those before you're born can have long-lasting, persistent effects that determine your risk of disease. But I'm going to try within this hallowed hall to contextualize it without, I hope, being too boring. If I'm boring, you can tell me. So there's Edinburgh. Lovely place. Bit of a black spot. Actually, it's not so much Edinburgh, it's more Glasgow. Because we in Scotland have the highest incidence of cardiometabolic disease in the Western world. Well, hey, unlucky us. Used to be those nice fins, but they managed to get rid of it. So we have this awful distinction of having rotten disease. And if you're born in the wrong borough here, your life expectancy is the worst in the UK. So these are rather distressing and depressing thoughts. Many people will say that the reason we have this heavy burden of disease is because of the Scottish contribution to international cuisine. I give you here the haggis, currently in season. Well, it was Burns Night a few evenings ago. And Glasgow's major contribution, the deep-fried Mars bar. Has anybody ever eaten one of these? Come on, tell the truth. What can I say? Bon appetit. I can tell you how many calories there are in that, if you like. Perhaps not. Many other people will say it's because of stress, the challenges in life. This sort of picture from Edvard Munch of the scream, the existential angst of life. Actually, Munch had a terrible existence himself, and probably his most horrendous painting, only when you understand its context, is this one here. This little girl is his younger sister, with her hands on her ears, at the deathbed of their mother. That's very, very upsetting. And it will come into the theme of what I'm going to talk about, which is exposure to stress in early life, and particularly before we're born. Munch also painted one of the most beautiful Madonnas, and it's in the context of her and her potential pregnancy that we will talk. Of course, stress we all think of as distressing, but as the doyen of stress biology, Hans Selye, said, without stress, there would be no life. It's part of our response to challenge and our ability to withstand it and indeed thrive on it that is crucial. A little bit of fundamental biology. When we're faced with a stress, be it in our hunter-gatherer days, a large predator like this, or if you have my job, maybe a head of a university, you recognize this creature. Then you have to make a response. And the instant response, of course, is adrenaline, noradrenaline, fight or flight. But beyond that, there's a response of the steroid hormones, the glucocorticoids, which make a great wave of secretion into the blood over the course of about half an hour to an hour. And that allows you also to survive the stress and recover. They do a lot of very beneficial things if you're faced with one of these charmless creatures. They mobilize fuel. If you like, they give you the deep-fried Mars bar. They give you the calories you need to see off and run away from these charmless creatures. They increase your blood pressure, because this isn't the time to be feeling a little hypotensive and wan. You don't want to die of the first scratch. And they make you feel good about yourself, because it isn't the time to start worrying about how you're going to pay your mortgage. You're going to get away from those creatures. Stop worrying about things, just get on with life. And they turn off all the things you don't need. So inflammation and wound healing, do it later. Otherwise, the wound that is so expensively healing is the one that is being gnawed by the lion or the head of the university. And this is how we use them clinically. I mean, we treat patients who have inflammatory diseases, arthritis, asthma. We give them glucocorticoids because they suppress inflammation so powerfully. They also turn off all the things we don't need to do. If you've just had a meal, let's send the blood to brain and to muscles to get away. Let's not waste time carrying on with digestion. Bone growth, tomorrow. Reproduction, in my experience, and it's now quite extensive, the only creature that thinks about reproduction and the opposite sex when faced with a terrible, stressful challenge is the medical student. Everybody else focuses on getting out of there. And glucocorticoids also do some very interesting things to the brain. They flip between a structure called the amygdala, which is about fear, and a structure called the hippocampus, which is about sitting quiet and learning and remembering. And you can imagine that if you lot all got horrible and cross with me, I wouldn't want to be sitting here quietly remembering what you're doing, what you're wearing, how many of you there are. All I need to know is that there's an exit there, there, and there, and that's where I'm going. And that's my amygdala functioning. And glucocorticoids help it to function. And they turn off the hippocampus, which I hope is what you're all using, as you listen to me, and you learn, and you think, and you say he's talking nonsense, or I might agree with him a bit, and you take in and learn things anew. The sort of things that are inhibited by glucocorticoids. So it flips your learning and memory to very crude, rapid fear conditioning and away from the detailed learning and remembering that you're doing now. All of this is highly beneficial and adaptive. But this is a patient of ours in whom this process has gone wrong because she's had elevated glucocorticoids due to a small benign tumor for a couple of years, and that beneficial rise of blood pressure has turned into high blood pressure, hypertension. She's on four different drugs. We can't control her blood pressure. That short-term rise of glucose to give her energy has turned into diabetes. She's having four or five injections of insulin a day, very badly controlled. That rise of fat to fuel the brain has become high bad cholesterol. She's going to get a lot of heart disease if it goes on for longer. The muscles have broken down, and you can see the thinning of her legs. She's got fat round the middle. That suppression of reproduction has become infertility. And if you go inside the brain, she, like everybody else with this condition, is depressed, and her hippocampus has shrunk to half its original size, and she can't learn or remember anything. But the real message is this picture. She's the same young woman, 6 months later, after we've taken out that benign tumor and her cortisol has gone back to normal, her steroids have normalized, her high blood pressure has melted away, her diabetes, we've stopped all the insulin and she's no longer diabetic, her muscles have regrown, her reproductive cycle has come back, her depression has lifted, and her hippocampus has regrown and she can learn and remember again. A most striking illustration of how powerful these hormones can be. Now we come to the meat and potatoes of what I'm going to say. If we ask the man, the classical man on the Glasgow omnibus, about the cause of most of the diseases that bedevil the Scottish population, he would say in his own inimical way, it's a combination of the genes you're born with and the adult environment. This, by the way, a demonstration of a Glasgow medical student in the days when I was the external examiner in Glasgow. And he'd be right. But there's a little more than that. We know about genes as causing the fundamental process. And the way many of these studies have been done is by comparing identical and non-identical twins and showing that identical twins have much higher agreement concordance rates for disease than non-identical twins. Non-identical twins are like any brother and sister. They share half the genes. Identical twins have exactly the same genes. And these illustrate, incidentally, the world's smallest and tallest identical twins, the world's fattest, and the world's blondest. And these are some well-known non-identical twins, for those of you who didn't see the movie. And what studies of identical twins who have exactly the same DNA and the same genes have shown us is that many diseases, heart disease, diabetes, high blood pressure, and in the mental health disorders, depression, schizophrenia, are highly similar. So if one twin has the disease, the other one is likely to get it, telling you about the genes. But there is still a space where there are differences, maybe 30, 40%, where there are differences, where one twin gets the disease, the other one doesn't. And everybody said that's the space in which the adult environment comes. But some unique studies, first done in Canada and then reproduced in part in Holland, of identical twins who were separated at birth, given for adoption, or identical twins who were reared together in their birth family and had the same environment, showed that for many of these diseases, particularly diabetes, schizophrenia, for which the most information is available, there was no difference in the concordance whether they were reared together or reared apart, which implies that the environmental factors that explain the difference operate before or at birth. So the very powerful idea. It's not just the adult environment, there is a very powerful environment operating on your genes to determine your risk of disease that operates before you're born or at birth. Which brings me to this picture. And those of you who want to can now go, ah. These are two young Scotsmen, demonstrating, of course, what us Scotsmen wear under our kilts. They were born on the same day in the Edinburgh Royal Infirmary to healthy, full-term women about 15 years ago. They were born at term. They're absolutely perfect. But one of these young men, we know from some epidemiological studies, grows up to have a very substantially greater risk of the diseases we've been talking about. The data come from this woman, Ethel Margaret Burnside, who was Hertfordshire Lady Inspector of Midwives 100 years ago. For 20 years, this single, unmarried woman ruled the roost across the entire county, insisting that all the midwives under her care maintained the most immaculate records of every birth that was going through their hands. She wasn't the only one. There were a number of people like this who in the early part of the 20th century maintained obsessional medical records of the births of all the children who went through their hands. Now, you won't remember this, but many years ago, we used to have an organization in this country called the NHS. You probably won't have heard of it, but it had this philosophy of providing healthcare to everybody in the country, free of charge at the point of delivery, according to each according to his or her need. And part of that, of course, is maintaining medical records, because otherwise when I see a patient, if I haven't got any records, I don't know what, you know, I'm getting old and I can't remember. I can't remember what I did last time, maybe 6 months ago, let alone what happened 6 or 10 or 20 or 50 or 80 years ago. Of course, nowadays it's too expensive to keep records, and so they were thrown away. But a few hospitals, desperately inefficient ones, like some of the Hertfordshire hospitals and hospitals in Preston and a few others, failed lamentably to throw away the old medical records, including these that were kept. And in 1987, a colleague of mine, David Barker, professor of medicine in Southampton, was wandering around trying to understand why heart disease was patchy in the United Kingdom, why it was more common in some regions than others. And he happened across Ethel Margaret Burnside's obsessional birth records. And he produced this chart of isobars. But these isobars aren't the next front about to blow over Scotland and shower us with rain. These are isobars of blood pressure. And these isobars of blood pressure are taking Burnside's data and looking then at the blood pressure of the individuals who Barker went back to 60 years later. And what they show is that those whose birth weight, so lovingly recorded, was on the low side, particularly if they happened in this study to have a big placenta, were those who had massively higher blood pressure. These isobars of blood pressure, this is 20 millimeters of mercury. I mean, to put that into context, if you cut every molecule of salt out of your diet, very difficult to do, you might make a difference of 10 millimeters of mercury. If you halve the salt in your diet, you make a difference of 3 or 4 millimeters of mercury. And here is birth weight determining 20 millimeters of mercury across a population. And building on this, first Barker and his colleagues, and then people all over the world. These data have been reproduced in India, in Africa, all over Europe, in the West Indies. Eventually, the Americans did it. Of course, they did it bigger and better. They're Americans. But they showed the same thing, that something about being low birth weight associates with a greater risk of disease later in life. Here, for example, are some of Barker's original data with Nick Hales on diabetes, showing that compared with a big baby, a small normal baby has 7 times the risk of getting type 2 diabetes. These are massively impressive data. They've been analyses of all of the reports, in this case 150,000 subjects for this is diabetes, showing that these data are there all the time. But there are some other points to make. These are normal birth weights. These are not severely undersized. This is the normal range of birth weight. And it's not just blood pressure and diabetes and heart disease. These are for depression. This is lifetime depression. Some Barker's original data, compared with a risk of 1 for a big baby, the risk of depression for a small baby is 3 times higher. Well, you can say this is only a few hundred babies. Some colleagues in Manchester surveyed every baby born over a dozen years in the whole of Sweden and Finland, 1.4 million babies, and found exactly the same result. So there's something about early life that has long impacts, and they impact on my favorite hormone, cortisol, the stress hormone. So these are original data we did with Barker's unit, showing that low birth weight individuals 60 years later have higher stress hormones, something we've now done in a dozen different studies. And to sum up all of this, if you're the small normal baby, you have about 3 times a lifetime risk of getting high blood pressure, 3 times the risk of diabetes, double the risk of dying of heart disease. I mean, us doctors are terrible at diagnosis, but at least nowadays we get death right, usually. Increased risk of osteoporosis, increased risk of depression, schizophrenia. And it's not as though there's a trade-off and somewhere down the line you get less cancer because overall mortality has increased. There's something about early life that is determining risk of disease and death. I'd love to say that I was telling you something completely new under the sun, but these are data from the second most famous geneticist of the 19th century, August Weismann. He was most famous for killing off the ideas of Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, the guy who, those of you who remember your scientific history, had the conflicting theory that Darwin killed off with his own ideas, that somehow the inheritance of characteristics came from the acquisition of those characteristics during the lifespan. Lamarck's example was the giraffe that stretched its neck the most to reach the succulent leaves towards the top of the tree, somehow or other in its lifetime got a longer neck and therefore passed it on to its offspring. And Weismann killed off that notion by taking 22 generations of newborn mice, chopping off their tails, and showing that the 23rd generation of mice grew a complete full-length tail identical to the original mouse, and therefore Lamarck's ideas were wrong, something known to little Jewish boys for 5,000 years. One or two of you worked that one out. I'm very pleased. Anyway, what Weismann did in this experiment is he takes clones of butterflies. These are genetically identical insects, and they've been incubated at different temperatures, and the adult looks completely different. So what we've known for 130 years is that the developmental conditions that an individual grows up in has long-lasting, persisting, permanent effects on, in this case, the color of the butterfly, but it could be anything else. If you're a reptile, it determines your sex. You know, incubate crocodile eggs. In warmer temperatures, you get females. Colder temperatures, you get males. So, you know, something as fundamental as that. And Barker has rediscovered, if you like, the human equivalent of it. And if you only want to take away one thing from this otherwise boring talk, it's that this is called developmental programming. It means that during development, an influence from the environment hardwires biology for the lifespan. It works during specific windows of sensitivity during development and lasts. And developmental programming is ubiquitous in the animal kingdom. Every time it's been looked for, it's been found. And it must be adaptive, because whatever has maintained it through evolutionary time has to be adaptive. You can think of it in this way, that low birth weight baby. Imagine it not born in the modern world, but born in a famine-stricken war zone, pushed out during the nastiness in Bosnia or World War II. Then a woman having a small baby, she's going to have an easier birth. The birth's going to be easier. That baby is going to grow quickly. It is insulin sensitized. It actually grows fast. It's got higher blood pressure, so it's not going to die of the first scratch. It's got higher stress hormones and is ready to deal with what the world throws at it. Its behavior is like attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. It's a street kid. Hopeless if you want to sit quietly in a class, perfectly adapted if there are Kalashnikovs going off in every corner. It goes through puberty early. It reproduces more rapidly and doesn't expect to live very long. That's adaptation. It's passed on its genes. And the associations with degenerative disease of grand old age reflect our modern way of life and not the underlying biology. So how could this come about, this association between small babies and later disease? Well, an obvious suggestion is that it's to do with genetics. A gene that causes you to grow less well also causes disease later in life. But there's a problem with that suggestion, which is that if you take identical twins who have exactly the same genes, the smaller at birth has the higher rate of diabetes and dies more early of heart disease. So the same associations occur within identical twins. Coming back to that point I made earlier about the missing problem of where the environmental impact comes when twins are reared together or reared apart, suggesting it occurs before they're born. It could all be confounded by social class. We know social class has major impacts on disease. But in all these thousands, now millions of children who've been followed, you can control for social class and the associations persist. Although I love this slide of John Cleese and the two Ronnies as they talk of social class. If you've seen the sketch, if you haven't seen the sketch, it's brilliant. Maternal malnutrition is a favoured process. A malnourished mother gives birth to an abnormal fetus. And a lot of science has been done in this, malnourishing experimentally, rats, mice, sheep, guinea pigs, you name it, and showing that you can produce models of the human observations. You reduce birth weight, and when the animals grow up, they have higher blood pressure and higher glucose. And indeed, there are some very striking human epidemiological studies taking a few atrocious events in modern history and looking at what happened to pregnant women. So the Dutch hunger winter in 1944-45, for 6 months, the occupying Germans decided to starve the urban Dutch. And they took their calorie intake down from a bearable 2,000 a day to around about 500 calories a day. That's a couple of moldy potatoes and a crust of bread. And they really did try to starve, and a lot of people died. And another great example was the splendid Chairman Mao and his great leap forward. When he heard that the Russians and the Americans, particularly the Russians, were making a lot of tractors, he decided to take all the peasants off the land and push them into factories. And of course, the crops rotted in the fields. And the Chinese admit to 20 million dying of starvation. And the truth is probably 40 million died of starvation in 59 to 61. And if you look at the offspring of women who were pregnant in these times, birth weight went down, actually not very much, 200-300 grams, half a pound. But the offspring was smaller, and they have higher rates of heart disease now. I mean, they're all grown up. They have higher rates of heart disease, and they have higher rates of schizophrenia particularly, and diabetes, and higher levels of my stress hormone cortisol. Show a picture of Audrey Hepburn, who was notoriously depressed and grew up in Holland, but unfortunately for my story, she was born before World War II, so that's a false association, but she was a great actress. So there we are. Genetics, no, not alone. Social class, controlled for. Maternal nutrition, great hypothesis, lots of data. And we came along with our stress hormones. Why? Because when these first became available as treatments in the 1950s and 60s, and where we used as magic bullets to treat everything, we very often gave them for every disease because we thought they would cure everything. Of course, they wouldn't. When we gave them to women who happened to be pregnant, babies were born small. But they change the maturation of the fetus. That's why obstetricians use them almost like Smarties. If a woman threatens preterm labor, to accelerate the maturation of the fetus's lung so that it actually survives birth. And very effective they are too. So because of this effect of glucocorticoids, we hypothesized that exposure to stress or its glucocorticoid hormones might cause that association between low birth weight and later disease. And did an obvious experiment where we gave a pregnant rat, now nearly 20 years ago, a small dose of the obstetrician's favorite glucocorticoid, stress hormone, and we gave it in a dose that reduced birth weight by about 14%. That's going from a 7-pound to a 6-pound baby. The animals caught up the weight difference very quickly, but for the rest of their lifespan, and now I'm showing you in green the animals that were given the glucocorticoid before they were born, they have higher blood pressure, higher glucose, and so forth. And it happens in both male animals and female animals compared with controls. So this is persisting programming. Blood pressure stays up, as does blood glucose and blood insulin levels. But it's interesting that this window of vulnerability for this is the last third of pregnancy. You can give the same stress hormone in the first or the second third, there is no persisting effect. You can treat postnatally. You do all sorts of bad things to the infant's growth. But once you stop the treatment, just like the patient I showed you with Cushing's, everything goes back to normal. It's only during this last week of pregnancy in a rat that these things persist. And we published these data a long time ago, and others have now done this in mice and sheep and guinea pigs and horses. And it's always consistent with the same thing. The offspring come out with higher blood pressure, higher glucose, higher insulin, behavior that looks anxious, which persists for life. And then people started looking back at some of those trials of giving glucocorticoids to pregnant women. This is Liggins' original trial, the first evidence of doing it, showing that 30 years later, after one dose of glucocorticoids given to pregnant women, not much changed, but they're insulin resistant, the beginnings of type 2 diabetes in 30-year-olds from one dose. And people have then taken this on, and exactly the same if you stress an animal, you get the same effect. Now that's important for medical treatment, for pharmacology, but the biology is a bit more complicated and it lies in the placenta. There's nothing that the placenta can do to stop the high levels of cortisol in the mum's blood from going straight across to the fetus. But it can inactivate them, and that's what it does. It stops the mother's stress hormones in large part from crossing to the fetus by an enzyme called, and this is a terrible name, I wish it was called whiz-bang, but it's called 11-beta hydroxysteroid dehydrogenase type 2, for which I apologize, since I think we discovered it. And what this one does is it inactivates cortisol to cortisone. Someone's immediately going to say, I had a cortisone injection for my tennis elbow. And you did. You had hydrocortisone, which is actually cortisol, and you have an enzyme which can turn cortisone back into cortisol. The fetus doesn't. So the barrier enzyme in the placenta protects it. And we published a hypothesis in a well-known journal of irreproducible results in which we suggested that relative deficiency of the barrier enzyme would be the same as giving a synthetic steroid that the obstetricians use, which doesn't get inactivated by the enzyme, and might allow extra glucocorticoids through. And indeed, in rats and in humans, those who have less of the barrier enzyme in their placenta go together with lower birth weight. And indeed, lower activity of that barrier enzyme in the placenta 3 years later goes together with higher blood pressure in the offspring. But that's just observation. To understand whether this is cause or effect, you need to go down to the sweet shop. Does anybody like these? I don't like licorice. But the good news is, licorice, which is one of the sweetest things on the planet, is put into all sorts of things. Anybody drink beer? Yeah, well, it's in beer as well. So licorice, for reasons best known to the licorice plant, has a very powerful inhibitor of that barrier enzyme. So powerful, the drug industry would be proud of it. And if you give a pregnant rat licorice, in green, it inhibits the barrier enzyme and takes down birth weight by 12%. And for the rest of the lifespan, the offspring have high blood pressure and high glucose levels and show behavior like ADHD and have high levels of stress hormones and all the things I've told you about. That's just getting rid of the barrier enzyme. Now that's becoming to tell you something a little bit more fundamental. And if I told you as well that if you malnourish, in this case a pregnant rat, it selectively takes down the barrier enzyme. So if you take down the protein in the diet of the mother from a quarter to less than 10%, that barrier enzyme disappears, and that stress gets rid of the barrier enzyme. And if the mother's ill, you get rid of the barrier enzyme with an infection in rats or in humans. It allowed us to come to a concept that this barrier enzyme in the placenta might be one of a few common mechanisms by which the maternal environment, be it her diet, her stress, her disease, signals to the fetus, in this case by the cortisol hormone going through, saying, hey, little Johnny, life out here is going to be tough. Better change your biology. Better get it right for a tough environment. These are predictive responses to a tough environment. Difficult to do this in humans, but my friend Vivette Glover at Imperial College produced some very interesting data in this regard, showing that the more anxious a mother, the lower the barrier enzyme, although she had to get very anxious for this effect to occur. A little bit of anxiety wasn't enough. And moreover, whilst mother's stress hormone, cortisol, has no relationship, as you would expect, to the levels in the fetus, in her baby, when the barrier enzyme is fully up, when she's very anxious, that barrier enzyme's gone down, and suddenly her hormones are impacting and related to the fetus's hormones as the barrier goes away. And that's very interesting. It also shows something very interesting too, which is that in humans, anxiety does not ubiquitously lift stress hormones. We all think we're stressed, but actually your own hormone levels are your individual property. So some of these very anxious women have pretty low levels of stress hormones, as we've known for a long time. The public perception that a stressful life is not the biological reality in us, which is why we're so difficult. But finally, we got round to finding some women who'd eaten licorice. We had to go to Finland, where they love the stuff, along with saunas and rolling around in the snow and beating themselves with birch twigs. I've never understood why they do any of these things, as I don't like licorice. But we found a population of women who had, purely by choice, taken a lot of licorice-containing sweets, basically a bag of those a day, because they like them. There was no difference between the women who liked licorice and those who didn't. They just liked it. There was no difference in social class or smoking or alcohol or occupation or education or weight. But the women who took about a bag of licorice a day, we then went back and looked at their 8-year-old children. And just like in the rats, the 8-year-old children had effects, particularly on their brains, which is what I'm showing you here. There was about a 10% drop in a variety of measures of what we loosely call IQ, the ability to perform mental tasks. Even more striking, ADHD was up by 2/3, 66%. That's a lot of ADHD, exactly as you find if you treat a pregnant rat with licorice. So that's conserved biology, at least in this population of a few hundred Finnish women. So perhaps licorice should have a health warning in pregnancy. How does this come about? How is it that something that goes wrong before you are born has persisting effects for the lifespan? Well, in principle, there are two things that can happen. It changes how a tissue, an organ functions, changes the number of cells. And we know that this happens, for example, in the kidney. The number of kidney units that filter blood and turn it into urine changes, depending on the early life experience. But the other thing that can happen, and these are ands, not ors, is that you can change the level of expression of a gene within an individual cell. And this is the story of epigenetics. And I'll try and keep it simple. Early on in this process, because we were interested in glucocorticoids, we looked at the receptors for glucocorticoids, which live inside cells and bind directly to the DNA and turn on target genes. And we showed that early life exposure to a stressed mother, a malnourished mother, or to the hormones of stress, or to licorice, which blocks that placental barrier, all of them change the glucocorticoid receptor, which went up in the liver, up in the bad fat that I have around my tummy, but not in the safe fat out in the arms and legs, and curiously down in the brain, particularly in the hippocampus, which is all about learning and memory, but also about the control of stress. This complicated cell-specific pattern made sense because the periphery is very sensitive to glucocorticoids, which are up. But it asked a question about how this happened on different cells in different ways. And I don't want to bore you with the fine details, but the glucocorticoid receptor gene starts from different places in different tissues to make the receptor. And in particular, this area in green here, called exon 1-7, is highly enriched in the brain and is highly susceptible to early life events. And to summarize an awful lot of work, if you're exposed in an early life environment, serotonin, the happy hormone, impacts on those, on those brain cells, sends a cascade of messages which bind to that particular region of the glucocorticoid receptor gene, leading to production of the protein. And if early in life you're exposed to stress or to excess stress hormones, there is less serotonin and that whole system is turned off. But that doesn't answer how this persists. And that comes from the study of epigenetics. It's a difficult one to explain, but I'll try. This is my copy of Darwin's Voyage of the Beagle. And this is all about the beaks of the finches that he found on the Galapagos Islands. If you take DNA as having, in its four-letter code, the words giving the instructions to make you, because that's what it has. That code encodes proteins, and the proteins make you and keep you going. The words in epigenetics are not changed. The code is there. It's about whether you can read it. So my metaphor is Tippex. You know what this is. And this is about whether you can see it. Early in development, when you're a few cells, there are great waves of, and we're specifically talking about a process called DNA methylation. It's adding a small methyl chemical group to DNA to make it readable or not, and when it's got methyl on it, you can't read it. Great waves of the page of the books of life are covered in Tippex and you can't read them, and then they're opened up. But later in development, individual genes and individual words are covered in Tippex or not. And it's very subtle about whether you can read a particular gene, a particular word of the book of life. But those genes have implications. This is the best example. These mice are all genetically identical. They were born to an inbred mother who's got an agouti gene. But they don't look identical. Even I can see that they're not identical. They're clones. They're twins. They're identical genetically. But they don't look it. And the reason is because of epigenetics. In the control region of the gene determining coat color, somewhere back in mouse evolution, millions of years ago, was inserted a virus. It's a retrovirus, you know, like HIV, one of these nasty things. But HIV is a very nasty one, but there are loads of these things, and it crawled into the DNA. And the first thing the body does is says, this is foreign, this is an enemy, and it covers it in methyl groups so that the body doesn't read it. But patchily, in this particular mouse, that methylation of the viral bit fails. And when the virus can be read, it reads through and turns on the yellow gene, illicitly. And the yellow gene is agouti. It doesn't sound as though it matters very much, but it's also an obesity gene, and these mice get horribly obese and die young. Now, this is just a crude example of these mice, all of them genetically identical, varying, but it shows the power of epigenetics, the ability to read the code, and that methylation of DNA early in life to determine what the mouse looks like, and in this case, its risk of becoming, of looking yellow and getting a nasty disease, obesity. Here's another wonderful example. This is the world's first cloned cat. So this is the copycat who is genetically exactly the same as its mum. In other words, these people, of course they were Americans, they lost Tiddles, who died, and they took a cell from Tiddles and took the DNA and a nucleus and gave it via cloning to a genetically identical cat, which they wanted to be exactly the same as their Tiddles. Only, of course, epigenetics stands in, and Tiddles' clone isn't the same as Tiddles. Not only was the behaviour different from the reasons I've just told you, but if you look carefully at copycat, all right, the new cat is smaller, but whereas Tiddles here has orange, the clone does not have orange. Why? Because that particular gene is subject to methylation and variation. Similarly, the size of the white spot in this piece is subject to epigenetic modification of a white spotting gene, and you end up with a different phenotype, a different appearance of a genetically identical individual. And for the glucocorticoid receptor, the early life environment makes an enormous impact on the methylation and therefore the readability of that 1-7 start point. And we'll come back to that a little bit later. I don't want to bore you with the details, but this is really, it is methylated and not red, or it is unmethylated and red. If it is unmethylated, you have more glucocorticoid receptors in the brain and you keep your own steroid levels low, healthy. And if it's methylated, the whole thing's turned off and you have higher levels of stress hormones. And that's exactly what we find. And if you think about that in the context of growing up in some of the tougher areas of Scotland, and these are pictures of Glasgow, you can imagine that if the human biology is like the animal biology, and Barker's findings and the other data I've shown you suggest it's similar, that the early life environment will have a very powerful impact, particularly before birth, although these children obviously are being impacted later in life. And these data, which came out of this month from the MRC unit in Glasgow, Carol Tannehill's group, suggest this is indeed the case. So this is total DNA methylation. So it's genes that are and can't be methylated. Most don't. And this shows that without much effect of age, those who are in non-manual jobs have more methylation, and most of this is turn off of those viruses you don't want, than those who live in much more straitened circumstances in manual occupations, lower socioeconomic classes. This is the whole of DNA, not just the specific thing I'm looking at, and we'll talk about that in a minute in Glasgow. But first of all, I want to show you about my hobby. I'm essentially the scientific equivalent of a train spotter. You know, these little boys who run around thinking that otherwise ostensibly identical locomotives somehow become much more fascinating because they've got different numbers on them. I'm sort of the Mr. Bean without hair of the hormone world. And I'm interested in metabolism, but I'm interested in a context which is much more serious. We've worked for some years with Rachel Yehuda, who looks after a population of Nazi Holocaust survivors, Jewish individuals who survived the camps through good luck and maybe good fortune and maybe their own wiles. But since 99.9% of people who went into concentration camps died, these are just lucky survivors. And she has a population of matched Jewish control subjects whose families left the same part of Europe but a generation earlier to go to the United States. So they're very carefully matched. And she's interested in a condition called post-traumatic stress disorder. But in this, we looked at total exposure. And we showed what she had previously showed, that in people who'd been exposed to the Nazi Holocaust, their glucocorticoid levels, you'd expect they'd be high, but actually they're paradoxically low. They're changed. And the reason they're low is a couple of those enzymes that destroy glucocorticoids, 11-beta-HSD2, which is in this case not in the placenta but in the kidney, and 5-alpha reductase, are strikingly reduced. I mean, they are reduced to a third of the normal level, 5 compared with 17, in those who had, now we're talking 60 years earlier, been exposed to Holocaust. And the crucial thing was that the younger they were at exposure to Holocaust, the greater the change. These people are all old, and they were exposed in young life. So this again suggests that the exposure to unimaginable stress and hardship has lasting effects, and in this case, not only on stress hormones, but on their metabolism. And these effects make some sort of sense. But of course, working with Holocaust survivors is very difficult because they were exposed to stress and challenge increasingly over a decade. And the Nazis didn't just appear one day and suddenly start stressing. This was something that built up all over the years from the mid-1930s. So we took the opportunity of 9/11/2001 to look and see whether a single stress would have an effect. And again with Rachel, looked at women who were pregnant, were in the Twin Towers, or in the immediately neighbouring buildings, obviously survived, got out. We found 187 of them. And we then looked to see whether a single stress would have an impact on the baby. And the answer is it does. And it's a very interesting delimitation. Because the only effect on the baby's cortisol, and we went back and looked at these babies when they were 9 months old, the only effect on the baby's cortisol was seen if the women got post-traumatic stress disorder, which about half of them did. So you'd say, well, a post-traumatic stress disorder afflicted mother changes how she looks after her babies. And that's what you're looking at. But it didn't happen if the mother had been exposed to 9/11 in the first or second trimester of pregnancy, only if she'd been exposed in the third trimester. And then if she was exposed in the third trimester, her baby showed this strange lowering of stress hormones. Don't get carried away with it. Their babies are super sensitive to their stress hormones. So post-traumatic stress disorder, not enough, but also exposure in the last trimester. Smells like all that programming I showed you from the data from animals. And these changes in the enzymes make sense, that we see both in 9/11, I'm not showing you the duplicate data, and also in Holocaust survivors, because these enzymes destroy cortisol. If you reduce the destruction of cortisol inside the liver, because in early life you were exposed to terrible stress hormones, you allow cortisol to persist, dragging out each last calorie of metabolic fuel that you can. If you allow cortisol to persist in the kidney, you allow it to retain every last molecule of salt in a presumed environment, which is the ancestral human environment, salt deplete. So this is a baby growing up in life, programmed to do what it really needs to do to survive in a terrible, shocking environment that's predicted. It retains every molecule of salt, it retains every single calorie it can, but unlike my patients with Cushing's, it doesn't have high blood cortisol levels. So it's not going to get the adverse effects on muscle and brain that would not allow it to survive. So all of this is adaptive. So there we are, you've got a programmed baby. It's been exposed to unimaginable hardship in the Holocaust or the terrible stress of being in 9/11. And it's set up with this strange biology, ready for anything. It's set up for an environment in which there'll be no calories and there'll be horrible things going on all the time and there'll be no salt and its blood pressure will be struggling to be kept up. And then you give it a mismatch. You put it into an environment where instead of deprivation and stress, there's calories on every blessed corner. And the stresses aren't physical, but mental. Here are some lovely data. This is the obesity epidemic. This is to give you an idea of an unexpected environmental stress. These are American data, but we could show identical data, less well collected, from Scotland. This is when they began, this is the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, and this is when they began collecting data on obesity rates in America. This is 1985. A few of you are old enough to have been born in 1985. Me, I was just a young doctor doing my bit on hormones. 1985, you will notice, only half the states report any data on, this isn't overweight, this is obesity. This isn't me being tubby around the middle. This is fat. Body mass index above 30. Most of the states that do report have tiny incidences of obesity, below 10%. 1985, remember it? You don't, you're too young. 1990, well, the first thing that happens is most of the states are recording, and those that are actually recording somewhere between 10 and 15%. So it's growing. That's 1990. It's gone another 5 years. There's 1995. You see how it's filling in? The colours are getting darker. I'm running out of dark blues. And you can see that by now, 10 years on, instead of being everyone below 10%, now most are in the 15 to 20% range. It's gone another 5 years. 2000, the millennium. Half the states have now got more than 20% obesity. Nobody has got less than 10%, and only Colorado, God knows what they do in Colorado, probably ski all the time, have got less than 15%. 2005, the colors have changed again. Everybody, except Colorado, have got more than 20% obesity, and some have even gone up to 30%, very few. And here are this year's data from 2010, and you can now see that half the states are above 30%. Nobody is below 20% at all. And most of them are in the 25 to 30% bracket. So that's an epidemic of things moving very rapidly, an environmental challenge. Now you add that as an environmental change to this baby that has been prepared for starvation and deprivation. And you won't be surprised to see our data mirroring those of others, but the Holocaust survivors have about double the rate of cardiometabolic disease. Because this is a baby that is set up for deprivation, and its biology is entirely inappropriate to the environment it suddenly finds itself in. Striking data. And there's another bit of complication. These things go on for another generation. Remember I showed you that if you gave a stress or a stress hormone to a pregnant rat, her offspring were low birth weight, and then for the rest of their lifespan, they have higher blood pressure and glucose and stress hormones, maybe insulin, we talked about this. Well, if you take those individuals and make them, again, no further challenges in the environment, so they were challenged before they were born through their mum, you take the offspring and make them, and the next generation, you get exactly the same effect. Low birth weight, and high glucose and insulin and everything else you would want. So it passes into the next generation without any further intervention. You will immediately say to me, well, that fetus is growing up in the womb of a mother who's got abnormal biology. And indeed, that's true. If you just take the mother, who herself was exposed before she was born via her mother's stress hormones, she gives rise, mate her with a control male, she gives rise to an abnormal offspring. But hang on a minute, there's another experiment that needs to be done here. Let's take the male. My wife tells me that the male contributes nothing to the nurturing of the offspring, either before it's born or afterwards, because I'm always through here in Glasgow giving talks while she's struggling with the wee bairns. So let's just take the male who himself was exposed to stress hormones before he was born and mate him with a perfectly healthy control female. Same effect. The offspring have higher blood pressure, higher glucose, higher stress hormones. It goes down the male line. The male contributes almost nothing. Well, he does contribute something. He contributes DNA and epigenetic changes. And this is the technical bit. For those of you who like these things, in those two generations, the first F1, the second F2, the offspring look identical, but the fundamental mechanisms that cause their biology are quite different. Don't worry about the details. This gene that is up in the first generation is not in the second. This one that's up in the first generation is down in the second. Quite different. They look the same, but it comes about in a different mechanism. And the epigenetics that underpin it, this is the main growth factor of the fetus, IGF-2. The epigenetic changes, both the first and the second generation show them, but they are different. But this also raises another thing, because the changes in epigenetics are always very small, 5-10% differences in methylation. In this case, on the main factor causing the growth of the fetus. But these patients give you a clue. These are rare human syndromes called Beckwith-Wiedemann, a rare cause of huge fetal overgrowth. These babies are very badly affected. They're huge, enormous babies with big tongues and big heads, and everything is overgrown. And this one is the reverse. It's Silver Russell. This is a terribly undergrown baby. It's the same gene that causes this, and it's an epigene. This is this insulin growth factor, IGF-2 gene, and it's all about how methylated it is. It's all about epigenetics giving this awful disease pairing. And the difference in methylation between this one and a normal, or this one and a normal baby, can be only 10 or 15%. So who's to say that 5% changes in difference of methylation of important genes don't underpin this relatively small change in birth weight and this relatively large change in disease risk? If it's a good harvest, a good weather year, the people eat. If it's a bad harvest, a bad weather year, they starve. Being Sweden, they've kept obsessional records for 120 years. Marcus Pembry, a colleague of mine from London, went back and looked at those records and then looked at disease rates. And what he found was remarkable. Here is the nutrition, in green, bad nutrition, of the grandmother when she was two or one. And she was born and lived her first 2 years during times of starvation. Her grandchildren have double the death rate of heart disease, double the incidence of diabetes, just like I showed you in the rats. It goes to a second generation. It's exactly the same with granddad, only with granddad, the time of vulnerability is not the first 2 years of life, and presumed by that one presumes what it was like when granny was in utero, but it's around about the time just before puberty. Why puberty? That's when his testes are developing and sperm are beginning to form, which is happening before birth in the rat. So that's telling you that exactly the same intergenerational transmission may occur in humans. What about the Holocaust? We can't do anything with the 9/11 people because their children are still only prepubertal. But we have gone back to Holocaust survivors and their children. And the first thing to say is that even Holocaust survivors' children who haven't been traumatized have a very high rate of psychiatric illness. But even in Holocaust survivor children born on average 15 years after Holocaust, so they weren't exposed to anything. And the ones who are healthy, don't have mental illness, show this funny low cortisol if their mums were exposed to the Holocaust. So mum's exposed to Holocaust. We know that she has these funny persisting low cortisol and all those enzymes that get rid of glucocorticoids changed. Her children, perfectly healthy ones, born long after the Holocaust, have exactly the same low cortisol and the same low enzymes, without any disease. We think this is a vulnerability factor. We think this makes these individuals vulnerable to mental and physical illness, in the same way as I showed you for the Holocaust survivors. And indeed, in 9/11, when we looked at those individuals who had those low enzymes, they were the ones who were vulnerable to post-traumatic stress disorder and its persistence, and didn't respond to simple counseling and support. It's a vulnerability state programmed by early life. If you've got it, you're vulnerable. You're susceptible to, in this case, post-traumatic stress disorder, providing a framework to answer why is it that exposed to the same horror, 9/11, the Holocaust in my terms, but it could be a motor accident or anything else, why is it that half of us are vulnerable, half resilient? And the suggestion is that early life events set up our biology to make us vulnerable or resilient. And this may be one of the processes. In the last couple of minutes, we're going to talk about what can be done, because otherwise this is all deeply depressing. Who knows where that is? Absolutely. Motherwell in all its glory. It does look a bit grim, doesn't it? In the 60s, this guy was the obstetrician there, and he was interested in trying to better the lot of the women. So he gave them a diet. It was rather a primitive diet, and you can see from his shape, I mean, he's 6 foot six in his stockinged feet, ramrod straight, silver hair. He told his gals what to do. They went away and did it. He was kind of intimidating. And he did this little experiment inadvertently. He gave them a diet. He said, meat. You've got to eat meat, girls. 1 pound of meat should be eaten every day of gestation. Quantity is more important than quality. So they went out and they didn't have any money, so they bought themselves Spam and corned beef. And basically, this is the Atkins diet. Remember old Atkins? The guy with eat all that fat and makes you smell and makes you lose weight because you get rid of glycogen containing water in your liver. It's a bit of a cheat, really. It's a medical student joke. How do you get rid of, make someone lose weight? Well, you stop them, get rid of some water, give them nothing to drink for a while, lose weight, and that's what the Atkins diet does. But it does some bad things. So this is women given the Atkins diet written large. And what he wanted was to make his women more healthy. And what he got was low birth weight, and when we went back to them, now 35 years later, they had, you guessed it, higher blood pressure, higher glucose, higher insulin, and depending on how well they stuck to whatever they were told, those that ate the most cheap meat and high fat, higher cortisol levels, higher stress hormone levels. And in them, we found 40 years later, exactly what I've told you before, that glucocorticoid receptor epigenetic change is higher in those who 40 years earlier, their mothers were forced or were persuaded to eat lots of cheap, fatty meat, correlated beautifully with the amount of fat. And the same in that growth factor gene that I showed you. More methylation, less glucocorticoid receptors, less sensitive to feedback, higher stress hormones. So can we do anything about this? It's the beginnings of some thoughts. This study was done by a veterinary colleague of mine who said, let's try and reverse this change in the receptor. More of it in the liver and fat. Maybe it's because they're insulin resistant. So let's give them an insulin sensitizing drug. So we have two that we use clinically, one called thiazolidinediones, and that didn't do anything. But the granddaddy of all anti-diabetic drugs is called metformin. And metformin selectively reverses the abnormality in the glucocorticoid receptor if only we were rats. But it does it in the rat. So might it do it in the human? It turns it back. We have drugs that can reverse methylation. They're actually in clinical use now. So might they work? Here's the agouti mouse. You can reverse its look by giving methyl donors, dietary supplements, to a pregnant mouse. You can get rid of the yellow ones by giving methyl donors like folic acid, vitamin B12, betaine. There's a little wobble in all of this. Would you want, of course you want, don't want to get rid of that nasty viral thing, but for the receptor I'm telling you about, you don't want to increase its methylation, you want to reduce its methylation. So we're not sure about the rules, but we can begin to manipulate these things, and we can certainly manipulate these things in adulthood. That methylation is not absolutely permanent. You can change it. This is a nice little trick. A group in Buckingham did this. You take a pregnant rat that is malnourished. You remember I told you the barrier enzyme goes away with the malnourishment and weight drops of the fetus? If you trick the pregnant mum by giving it the fat hormone leptin, which is basically the I'm a happy fat cell hormone, so you have a completely malnourished mother, but you give her the happy clappy fat hormone leptin, the barrier enzyme is tricked into going back up again, birth weight goes back up again, and in other studies they showed the behavior goes back and the blood pressure goes back. Well, that's in a rat, and we don't know if it works in a human, and leptin would cost an arm and six legs to feed to anyone. But at least it allows you to think of ways of trying to reverse this process. So I've shown you a lot of things. I've suggested to you that a lot of things in the maternal environment can program the offspring. And the outcome of various maternal challenges, be it her malnutrition, be it stress, be it infection, all look about the same. The offspring come out with higher blood pressure, higher glucose, ADHD, anxiety, those sorts of things. I've suggested that stress hormones are a powerful mediator and that a barrier enzyme in the placenta may be a key node in all of this. And if we can boost it, it might be a good thing. And I've shown you, I've tried to explain how epigenetic alterations are a way of thinking how early life events can persist for the lifespan without changing the DNA and might flip into the next generation. Which is worrying, but what I haven't told you is that the third generation, it seems to have gone away. So born into Glasgow neediness, exposed to a McDonald on every blessed corner, you'll have problems for a couple of generations and maybe it will fade, and there are some data to speak to that. I think the most important things, before you all sit there phoning your mums up and saying, what was my birth weight? is to say that not everything is written in your genes, and it's certainly not written in your epigenes. You have an awful lot of ability to determine what will come of you, whether you smoke, whether you eat healthily, whether you live healthily. That's what you can do, and that's really important. And the future? Well, we don't really understand yet completely the rules of this effect. We don't understand how important it is. It's probably about a third of the risk of these diseases that we worry about. These epigenetic marks are very interesting. In many ways, they're better than blood tests because, or blood pressure measurements, because blood pressure's going up and down all the time. These epigenetic marks seem to be relatively stable. You can influence them, but they're relatively stable. And you can do something about them, unlike your genes, which you can't do anything about. They also allow us to think of ways of personalizing therapy. If my patient with type 2 diabetes, that disease that's growing rapidly through the population as we get fatter, 10% of us maybe, if my patient has had it because of their genes, then now we'll work out which genes and think what's the special therapy. If it's happened because of their epigenes, we'll measure it and say, well, maybe metformin is the best treatment for you, Mrs. Smith. And if it's because of the fact only that they eat far too much, then, well, we know very well that telling people to eat less isn't terribly effective, but maybe we send them to the bariatric surgeon. Or maybe we find a good way of persuading them to eat less. But there is a caveat, because this biology has survived hundreds of millions of years of evolution. So it must be beneficial. I've tried to explain the context, the low birth weight baby born in the famine-stricken war zone. But we don't really understand that enough yet to know where it's beneficial and where it's disbeneficial. So interfering blindly by putting methyl donors in every pregnant woman's breakfast cereal is probably a bit premature. We'll certainly get my favorite glucocorticoid receptor completely wrong. And trying to do crude things in very subtle biology would be a mistake, in my view. Nonetheless, it's opening up a completely new way of thinking about how we personalize treatment, which is a good thing to do. So you give the right patient the right treatment, minimizing side effects, maximizing benefit. I've had, for the work I've shown you from my own lab, the privilege of working with a lot of highly talented individuals who are named on this slide. And the other thing about doing medical science is you get a lot of friends all over the world, and it's not a load of jollies. You spend a lot of time doing really interesting things with people all over the world, sometimes meeting, sometimes emailing, sometimes interacting, and that's what's good about medical science. People mostly will work together on what are really tough and intractable questions, and that's good. That means that our taxpayers' money is being used to its best advantage. And I'll leave you with a thought. You can't completely avoid early life stress, so you better not try. Thank you very much.